for the memories. You've got a friend in us. This is episode 31, The Green Mile from 1999. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski. And Mike, with us tonight, we have who I'm describing, based on his Letterboxd review, a self-described Green Mile sobber. We have Mr. Dan Colon. Hello, Dan.
That is correct. What's up, guys?
I have read online, from your own words, that no movie makes you cry quite like The Green Mile.
Yeah, I didn't realize that until I rewatched this movie. I had always known that it was a tearjerker for me, but quite some time since the last time I watched it. And this time I sobbed to cried no fewer than four times.
Wow. You are not alone, my friend.
That is four more times than I did.
As I like to say over here, Niagara Falls.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
At what points? Like, I get the one, but like, what other points?
Just all throughout different moments.
I got caught up. I would say I ranged from sobbing to crying. I mostly sobbed. But like, for example, the scene with Patricia Clarkson when she has her healing moment, you know, I sobbed through that. But like, by the end of this movie, I was ugly crying on my couch by myself.
I mean, I think I even started when old Hank starts breaking down in the retirement home. I'm like, oh shit, like here it goes. Like I'm already starting.
And that's something new, I think. I don't think we've had old man Hanks yet, have we? Like a different actor playing him? Because you know, I tracked that through the years of different actors playing, you know, different actors we following, other actors playing them, you know, especially like Shia in Nymphomaniac and Cage in a couple movies and stuff. But I think this is the first time we have Hanks as not Hanks.
It's funny how he's the young version in this, right?
Yeah, in some research I did before recording, I learned that they wanted to use Tom Hanks and put him in old makeup, but it just didn't look right, so they recast him.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't. It's not the only thing that reminds me of A League of Their Own in this movie. There's another famous scene, I think, but it's like when Gina Davis, right, they used another woman as the older version of her character, yet they still did they used her voiceover. They used Gina Davis's voice, so at least they,
right.
I think it was good not to do any of that this time.
All right, now before we get too much further into Green Mile or A League of Their Own again, because I was reading about a baseball player, and it's basically the guy, A League of Their Own, that I think Jimmy Dugan was based on, so I was reading that this week, so I have a lot of A League of Their Own on the brain. You guys are talking about it there, but before we go further and talk about whatever, Mike, for anybody who has not seen the 3-hour and 8-minute Green Mile, please let the people know what this movie is about.
Okay, so 1935, Louisiana. The Green Mile is death row, basically, and that's where our story takes place. Hanks runs it with a few other officers in there. You got Barry Pepper, we get David Morse, Jeff DeMunn. It's nice to see Barry Pepper back there from Saving Private Ryan. Anyway, as the story goes along, they are in charge of a new inmate, John Coffey, who is there because he had murdered two little girls.
Mike, you forgot the most important thing, like the drink, but not spelled the same.
Oh, I beg your pardon. M-O-O-N, that spells coffee. That's all I kept thinking. Something is up with him. I'm not sure if he's got The Shining, if he's part of the Beam. This is all sort of Stephen King terminology through his mythology, but he is very magical, and he cures Hanks's urinary tract infection, so he can go four times in one night with his wife, which he hasn't done since 2019. I'm going to speed this up a little bit. The movie becomes about a mouse for a while, Mr. Jangles. We meet the other inmates, Edouard Delacroix. We meet Percy Whitmore, the evil officer who comes onto the block. We have Sam Rockwell in an Oscar-worthy performance as Wild Bill Wharton, who is just like evil incarnate, who actually killed the girls that John Coffey was arrested for. You know, there's a lot of activity on the block that we'll get into, but ultimately, John Coffey, he and Hanks and the rest of the guards, they really form sort of this kinship, a friendship, and an understanding. And I mean, by the end, they are very sad to see him go, but it is his time, as he says. And turns out that when we wrap back around, Tom Hanks is a spry 108 years old due to the magic that was passed on between him and John Coffey at one point, and he is still taking care of Mr. Jangles the mouse, who has also acquired a longevity in life due to this magical interaction. And that is, you know, kind of in a nutshell, The Green Mile. There's a lot going on in those 3 hours, but the gist of it is that.
So this movie is a, like you mentioned, a Stephen King adaptation. It is a Frank Darabont Stephen King adaptation. He has made 4 movies, 3 Stephen King movies and The Majestic. I don't know how that happens, but that happens. 3 also maybe the 3 best Stephen King adaptations? Is that up for debate?
This, Shawshank
and The Mist.
3 very good ones.
Yeah. Dan has read the books before, so I want you to speak to that a little bit. But this, the interesting thing of note is that he released these as a serial as opposed to like one, I can't imagine, 600, 800,000 page book as Stephen King is wont to do.
Yeah, so this was originally published as a 6-part serial. about 100 pages a piece. The final installment's a little longer than that, but they were released about a month apart, so people would get 100 pages at a time, have to wait about a month to get the next part. Stephen King really enjoys that serial format. You know, I think he loves that old style. He's done it before with Gunslinger, and I want to say he's done it. I mean, he definitely did it early in his career, writing for mystery and horror magazines. So I think this was his way to kind of throw it back a little bit and tell a story in a way that he hadn't done in quite a while. So yeah, originally published as a serial, and then it became collected as a novel. Personally, I think it reads better as a serial. The installments begin kind of with a little bit of a recap of what had already gone on. It's all told from the perspective of Paul Edgecombe.
The Tom Hanks character.
Yes. He's writing in a journal, and he's recounting all of these experiences he had on E-Block in the prison. In the movie, he's telling the story to another woman at the nursing home. But in the books, he's writing it all down so as not to forget. You know, as he gets older, his memory starts to go. So this is his sort of therapeutic way to keep all of those memories intact. And for the most part, like a lot of Darabont's, like all of Darabont's King adaptations, this movie is incredibly faithful to source material. I couldn't really find a whole lot of places where he strayed from the books at all. There's like few characters in the periphery who were cut out for obvious reasons. They don't really amount to much. But for the most part, this is, again, a really, really faithful adaptation, even down to certain lines of dialogue, which I thought were pretty funny.
Well, then let's get right into it. Dan, what was your favorite part, whether it's something that's adapted well from the book that you loved in the book, or if it's something that's, you know, special or different about the movie? What was your favorite part about this adaptation of The Green Mile?
So I think that, yeah, my favorite thing about this movie is probably how well Percy was adapted to the screen, which is tragic in how that actor's career went, Doug Hutchinson. One of my notes was that his career was really such a waste.
Well, what happened?
The two things I know about him is that he was on Lost, and then he married Courtney Stodden when he was like 45 and she was 18.
That's him?
Yeah, man.
Yes.
No way. Oh my God, he's amazing in this movie.
Yeah. In the books, there's a moment where Paul is talking about how in the nursing home, he caught the movie Kiss of Death on TV. In the movie, he catches Top Hat, which conjures other memories. But the 1947 film Kiss of Death...
Not the Nicolas Cage Kiss of Death, apparently.
That's the remake of the movie that Dan mentioned, yeah.
Okay.
And he specifically mentions that when he sees Richard Widmark's character in that push an old woman in a wheelchair down a flight of stairs, that to him was exactly Percy Whitmore. And I think Doug Hutchinson really like knocks this character out of the park. Everyone else has really brought their A game to this movie, for sure. I think Hanks is incredible. But I think that for this one-off performance, Doug Hutchinson came out of nowhere and really nailed this character, in my opinion.
Yeah, he is a evil son of a bitch. Like, he almost reminds me of one of, like, the perfect Stephen King characters, in a way. In this movie in general, in this story, sort of. Like, I love how Stephen King it is without being too over-the-top and magic. I mean, it is magical, of course, but it, you know, there's no like killer clowns. Like, it doesn't get like that. Like, it's more of a, like, on an adult level.
I mean, I looked at the timestamp, you know, it takes about an hour for anything magical to happen in this movie. You know, it is, for all intents and purposes, a prison movie, much like Shawshank, except, you know, it's got these brief moments. I think there's three or four in total where the magic happens. They're brief, but man, do they make an impact.
So I don't want to disrupt the flow of the podcast that we normally do, but when we're talking about the Percy character, the thing that drives me crazy about Stephen King adaptations, I've only read a handful of his books, and it's more the recent ones, and I've loved some of them, I have not loved some of the other ones. But what frustrates me about the movies, like the It movies and some parts of this, is that it really, I don't want to say bothers me, but I don't get anything out of the characters that are pure evil. Like, I don't enjoy to any extent the characters like the Sam Rockwell character or like the Percy character. Like, it just feels like his characters, at least when they're adapted for the screen, and maybe it's true to the book, maybe it's not, but so much of like Derry in It, everyone is either like 100% evil or 100% pure. And that's my biggest issue with a lot of Stephen King adaptations, because it just feels like, and maybe it's more nuanced in the book, or maybe it's true to the book, I don't know. And Dan, I'd be interested in you seem to say that like this is a pretty faithful adaptation, but it feels to me like it's not interesting to have somebody who's just pure evil, because there's never a moment where you want to root for him. And I get the idea of wanting a villain, but he's just so terrible from start to finish. And I get wanting to root against him, and I get that it's a great performance, but that's my least favorite thing about this. And I will talk more about the other stuff later and everything, but like, it frustrates me how just black and white everyone is. Like, John Coffey is interesting to me because he is this, you know, hulking behemoth of a man who we quickly learn is not what he appears to be. And I think that he's an interesting dynamic character as such. Like, the Percy character is just like a sniveling little weasel who is always harping on the same notes, like, I'm going to tell my daddy on you, or like, I'm going to tell these people and you're going to be out of a job, and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, and like, screw you, this is, I'm the best. And like, it's so consistent, and like, the performance is great. I want to make sure that I don't discredit that. But at the same time, to me, that's boring. It's like, there's no dynamic there. It's just, he's evil. You're supposed to hate him. Cool, I get it. Why is he still on screen?
It's interesting because there was a point where I did think he was going to turn around. I've only seen this twice. And I think this movie is filled with parallels. And I think at a point you're supposed to think he is going to be the ultimate villain. But then like Sam Rockwell shows up and sort of puts him in his
place. And the same thing there. Yeah, too. Like, it's the same vibe, I get.
Yeah, it's like the dynamic though. Without that, you wouldn't have John Coffey the way he was. Like, he's pure good. And like, people may think, to a certain degree, that's kind of boring as well. Or even Hanks, the way that he is so honorable and yet still cuts corners, but, you know, for the right intentions. And I understand how that could be frustrating. And I don't think Stephen King's entire oeuvre is filled with characters like that. Like, there are levels, and this is way more sort of on a base level, I think, you know, like, I think it's Death Row. So we're going to get like pure evil people.
But... Right. And I do want to say that, like, you know, I compared this to It, but like, I like almost none of It. I wish that I liked It. I don't like the It movies. This, I like most of this movie, so I'm willing to give that credence. You know, like, I don't, these type of characters like draw me out of it. Like, I don't mind them here. I just wish that, like, if they were more nuanced, if we got a sense of like why they were the way they were, other than just like they're sadistic fucks, if they were more well-rounded, I would like think this is like maybe like a close to a perfect movie. But there's something there that's missing for me that doesn't click with me.
I hear you. The last thing I'll just say is, like, I think if you're more into the greater King universe, there might be stuff you can bring to something like this, like I did, to sort of help explain sort of people's motivations and things. Like, when I see Sam Rockwell, I just think Randall Flagg, and like, that might not mean anything to a lot of people, but like, if you've read a lot of Stephen King and you're familiar with like The Stand and stuff, you understand that character's influence, and that you can sort of read deeper into this if you have more of like a back knowledge, I guess, of his works and stuff. But I also understand frustration of people just coming to it for this single movie as well.
King is one of maybe my all-time favorite novelist, and he really enjoys stories about pure good and pure evil facing off. And then the story that he's telling is about the everyman caught in the middle of that. The Stand is very much a version of that story. And I see that here. And I don't think that in this particular story that John Coffey being the, you know, the pure good character, and we can say Percy and Wild Bill are the evil characters. I don't think they're meant to be the most dynamic. I know that you're looking for more dynamics in there, but I don't think that they're meant to be, because we're following Paul Edgecombe's story.
Right.
He's the character who's being changed by this. Him and the other men that he works with on E-Block, they are the normal people who can't fathom how, you know, John Coffey could have this magical ability. They also have never really seen guys like Wild Bill before, who just can't seem to be tamed. And no matter what they do, they can't rein Percy in. He's like a runaway train on his own mission. He's going to do whatever he wants, and they can't stop him. To a lesser degree, you know, we definitely see Percy's true colors in a couple scenes. He's ultimately a coward. But I mean, the story is about the guards on this block. And I think that that's where you're going to see the most dynamics. And those are the most interesting characters in this story.
Right.
Because we are meant to empathize with them. Right. So I get your frustration. Maybe it's because I've read a lot of King that I don't see the flaws in characters like Wild Bill and Percy and John Coffey the way you do. Maybe just used to that sort of storytelling.
I want to give this movie the benefit of the doubt because, like you're saying, it's not about those characters. What bothers me a lot about the It movies is that, like, the kids we're following are all, like, 100% pure, and almost everyone else we encounter in the movie is just 100% evil. And, like, that just, it's such a boring, it's either one or the other extreme. Here, there is nuance. There are layered characters that Hanks can be kind of a gruff guy, but he can also be a really kind and tender guy. Like, I like almost all of the characters here. It just feels like when he's able, like, whether it's the stuff that's from the novel or the adaptation of the screenplay, that like they're able to bring such three dimensions to the different characters, and then to have these intentionally so, like I get that, intentionally so, just pure evil, it's boring to me. And I'm not really upset about it because it's not about them. Like, I totally agree with you there, Dan. Like, they're sort of peripheral for one reason or another, but like, I still wish that they were either somehow in it less. Like, I wouldn't mind lifting some of their scenes out. Like, I get that, like, they're evil, and I think that the payoff, like, even if Sam Rockwell's in 5 minutes less, that doesn't make the ending any less poignant that he's the one who killed the girl. You know what I mean? Like, we don't need to see him do five horrible things. We can see him do three horrible things, right? Like, I just wish that there was either less of them because it's not enjoyable to me, or that they just had some kind of, like, here's why they're terrible or something.
Sure. I might agree with you if this movie wasn't 3 hours and 8 minutes. I think that the length of this movie gives a lot of that stuff room to breathe, because there's so many plates spinning here. There's so many like subplots and characters all have their own motivations. And like I said, the magical stuff doesn't even come into play until about an hour in. I hadn't remembered how much time was spent just on Mr. Jingles in that first hour.
Oh yeah, it's like a whole movie just with him and Delacroix.
And I'm glad you brought him up, because I do want to say that Mr. Jingles is my favorite part of this movie. I love that dang mouse.
It's the best. It's the and him and Michael Jeter's performance, I think, was my favorite part of this movie this time, who plays Edouard. And I think that's a really great character in here too. He's sort of maybe more of what's lacking, right? Like, you see how well behaved he can be, but then when Percy pisses his pants, you see that look in his eye and he just won't let it go. Like, you can tell he's done terrible things, and he feels like a way more nuanced character with a lot, you know, more going on, more of a gray area, right? As opposed to maybe John and Bill or something. And I think that's what makes him a little more interesting to me. I think that's why the actor has sort of more to explore there. There's more to chew, and it makes sort of his rivalry there, you know, with Percy have more weight. And definitely when he's executed, it's one of the most horrible things ever, like, committed to celluloid. Like, that is just horror.
To expand on that a little bit, I think that across the board, this movie really excels with the casting. As much as I love King, and I think that the story he wrote is exceptional, I think that the casting here really made these characters come alive and made them more complex in a way that I don't think King could do on the page. I love Bonnie Hunt in this movie. You know, like, her character is not much of a character in the book, but seeing her on screen with Tom Hanks, they're one of my favorite on-screen couples. I'm so jealous of that relationship.
We haven't even really mentioned Hanks yet, the man himself, but like, seeing him in the first half of this movie suffer from the UTI is just like, you know, I think it means more because it's Hanks, right? Like, I feel like he was perfectly cast for this role because I don't know if I necessarily come into it with a lot of empathy for his character, you know, like, yeah, he's kind of just this guy with a shit job, basically. And like, you know, he's just going to do it by the numbers and stuff. And it's really not until this encounter, which is his last encounter on the mile, that it really all kind of sinks in that there is like more of a meaning to it, I guess. But there's just something about having Hanks there, it being Hanks and like the rest of this cast, like you said, like just a great ensemble. When like James Cromwell has to show up for a few minutes and like doesn't really have much to do, and there's this little backstory about his wife, but then like when we come to the end and actually healing his wife, like I feel like it's because it's James Cromwell, right? Like that brings more weight to the character, and because it's Hanks, like I'm bringing things about Hanks to the role and stuff. So I hate to see him suffering, and I want to see him successful and like all this kind of thing and stuff. So I totally agree. Like, this is so well cast, and Sam Rockwell, I know he finally got an Oscar, but like his whole career is just an Oscar, man. Like, he is just amazing.
It's funny that you mentioned Rockwell, because I was watching this and I had to remind myself that in 1999, Sam Rockwell was not, you know, Sam Rockwell. And I think that's to the benefit of the character. To watch it now, over 10 years later, you know, I'm watching and I'm like, oh, hey, it's Sam Rockwell. And then the whole bait and switch you get with his character at the beginning of that, it's a little bit lost now if you've never seen this. But in the moment, I saw this movie in the theater. My grandmother took me, I think I was 12. And he's like a shot out of a gun, you know, like I had no idea what to expect from this guy. But, you know, yeah, in hindsight, we know it's Sam Rockwell and he's going to do something crazy.
And Harry Dean Stanton showing up for a few minutes, right? Like all of the small, Bill Sadler, I loved seeing him, like all the small roles. levels are.
So, Mike, you said that your favorite part is the mouse and Michael Jeter, but also the casting in general, right? Is there anything else you wanted to point out in terms of your favorite moments?
Yeah, I mean, well, like, I think you saw on Letterboxd, like, I gave this movie 5 stars. Like, I just was not expecting to be so overwhelmed by it, basically. Like, it almost, I mean, I have a whole sort of newfound appreciation for the romantic comedy, right? But back in the day, you know, those used to sort of be referred to as, like, chick flicks, right? And, like, guy movies were, like, action flicks and stuff. But, like, this, to me, feels like what would have been referred to as, like, a guy's chick flick, almost. Where it's just, like, I'm so emotionally wrapped up in this film for one reason or the other that, like, after watching it, something is like, you know, it's like cathartic or something, at least this time, you know. It's only the second time I've seen it, right? And it's a watch, so like it's like I went through something almost.
I don't know if it's as much of a guy chick flick as The Shawshank Redemption, like that's a total like bro romance, but I definitely agree with that sentiment for sure. This is definitely one of those types of movies,
you know. As we transition from what we liked to what we didn't like, I do want to go back to what I didn't like, and I do want to give credit to the pure good versus pure evil thing. I think that there's something here that, even though I don't like those dynamics as I talked about, there's something nice I just remembered in my notes, is that like when Sam Rockwell grabs John Coffey's arm and there's like the transfer of power or something, like it's not exactly clear what's happening. And Mike, you mentioned in the description there is like maybe it's The Shining, maybe it's something, like there's something at play here with John Coffey. I think that there's something interesting about that dynamic, about like the physical pass through of pure good to pure evil, or pure evil to pure good. Like, I think that's something interesting that I know you can't maybe fully explore, because like, how would you explore that? Because I think it's better left undescribed. But as much as I don't like that dynamic, and that is my least favorite part of the movie, I do like that moment where it's like, oh, there's more here. And it's almost like heat against cold. Like, he just, it's so uncomfortable just to the touch, because like they're so polar opposites. I thought that was a really nice touch there.
Yeah, I do like how John is like this conduit, and he feels things that he doesn't even touch. And then when someone like Wild Bill touches him, it's like power overload almost or something. And I think maybe that's when he gets the idea that he's going to sort of save all of that, whatever he takes back from Patricia Clarkson, right, to like cure her. I think that's when he gets the idea to hold on to it till he gets back to the prison, because he's like, yeah, some way Wild Bill's got to go. Like, this guy cannot, he's got to go before he's even going to be executed. Like, somehow he's got to go sooner than later.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I'm sort of surprised that they don't do any, they don't intervene, but it's also like, that's the, oh yeah, this is bad. Like, things are bad. Like, this isn't, things are bad here. So, Mike, what about you? Is there something about this that I know you mentioned you gave it 5 stars in Letterboxd. Is there something about this that you don't like? What's your least favorite part of The Green Mile?
Yeah, it is tough. I mean, I think it just mostly comes down to, like, I don't like it because it's, like, just a brutal thing to watch. Like, when Delacroix gets executed, like, that didn't really need to be that graphic. Like, things like that, you know? Like, I mean, it's there because it's, like, super well done, of course, and, like, probably very realistic, but that's something I really didn't need to see. You know, it really drives the point home. I think the stuff, you know, as much as I've been going on a bit about how well they pulled it off, I think the stuff with Melinda, with Patricia Clarkson as the wife, like, isn't really sort of, for the 3-hour movie, they don't really spend as much time as I was expecting with James Cromwell and his wife and stuff. You know, if they're supposed to be friends and they don't really have much of a social life at all in this area. And so it's really nothing like, it's nothing more than that, really. You know what I'm saying? Like, I do really love the way this movie comes together. As Dan said earlier, lots of plates spinning in the air, and I really feel like none of them crash to the ground and break. I mean, maybe there's like a chip in one of them, but that's about it.
Yeah, there is a lot going on here, and I think that it is balanced really exceptionally well. I would agree that there's very few missteps. I mean, aside from my personal preference of what I keep harping on over and over again, like the balance between stories, between storylines, between characters, between time, even, like, you know, in the beginning, I'm like, why are we still in the nursing home for 15, 20 minutes? And then I'm like, oh, we kind of need to establish that, because we're going to come back to it in the end, right? So, like, everything is sort of done specifically for a reason, and I think it's done very, very well. And you're right, the ball is not really dropped in any regard, I don't think.
No, I think maybe the movie, the moments are, there's like one or two moments where it just calls too much attention to itself as a movie. Like, when they're breaking John out of prison, like, it's so well done. And like we mentioned, like, Sam Rockwell grabs him out of nowhere, and he's supposed to be sedated. But then they're like running across across the yard and like dodging the spotlight, and it's just like kind of goofy. And then like when Percy gets put in the asylum, they play like this really goofy music as if to say, all right, that's wrapped up, like end of Percy's story. It's almost like these little like buttons that don't really need to be in certain moments, I guess, but that's it.
And Dan, what about you? What about this movie does not work for you? Is there something about this that you don't like, your least favorite part of The Green Mile?
Yeah, I've got that. I think just to address a little bit of what you guys were talking about, I so much love this cast that I find myself just enjoying a lot of these moments that some may find unnecessary. I know this movie is over 3 hours and it is a pretty hefty time commitment, but I gotta say, I just watched this the other day and I wasn't bored at all by any of it. I think that it moves pretty quickly. It's got a very even pace and it's always interesting to watch, in my opinion. Like even those small moments with Bonnie Hunt, you know, unnecessary they may be, you could definitely make that case. I just enjoy those human moments. It could be that I've got some experience as an actor under my belt, so I appreciate just like those intimate moments that don't necessarily drive the plot forward, but you know, just make these characters a little more human, right? So I enjoy all of that. But if I have to take one thing away from this movie, because I did give it 4.5 out of 5 stars, I think that it gets a little bit too preachy, is not the right word. I'm struggling to find it. But in the end, you know, when Michael Clark Duncan has his whole speech about how this is the way things are every day all over the world, it gets a little bit heavy-handed with its message, and I don't necessarily need to be beat over the head with that. And I think that's a little bit King's fault, not so much Frank Darabont, though he may be partially to blame for that as well. I just find the theme of this movie to be a little bit overt, and I don't think it's necessary.
Theme, as in, you want to elaborate on that a little bit, like the racism elements?
Not necessarily that, just that like John Coffey has been around for a long time and people are terrible everywhere. And when he shows Tom Hanks, Paul Edgecombe, he passes on his version of what happened, or, you know, the when he touches him, to make that point that, you know, people are terrible everywhere. I'm like, okay, yeah, I get it. You know, like that, it's almost like they're stating the thesis in that final moment. And I don't necessarily need it spelled out to me that way.
I hear what you're saying. It's tough though, because you almost need this moment with John at the end where he has like his moment of clarity, because the whole movie he's just scared shitless,
right?
And like kind of can't really communicate, you know. He's a man of very, very few words, and it's not until like he knows that he can finally rest that it sort of seems like he's got his wits back. And he is a very simple man, and so like I feel like, yeah, he would have a very simple message and it would be very as clear to follow as possible. And technically this movie is 1935, right? It takes place in 35 in the South. And so like, I feel like at the time, like this is fine for the time that the movie takes place. But in 1999, it is sort of like too I don't want to say too Hollywood, but maybe too sort of like old school Hollywood at that moment. Like it's riding such a nice line of being a period piece, but also feeling very modern and fresh and sort of 90s and like made it very extremely well. And then it gets to that moment and it's like, wait a minute, is this movie made in 1935 all of a sudden? Like what kind of happened there? So I understand where you're coming from.
For as long as this movie is, it never really stops being an intimate story, because, you know, this cast of characters that, like, even though there's what, maybe like 10 to 15 characters in this movie, it's all set for the most part within E Block and a few other locations. So it feels very small and intimate. But then you've got this message that John Coffey is presenting at the end that expands to the rest of the world. And suddenly it's not an intimate story anymore, you know? And it felt a little bit strange, but I understand what you're saying. And I don't know if there would have been a better way to do it, but I think it's just a little more sentimental maybe than I had hoped for. But again, John Coffey is an uncomplicated hero character. So, you know, maybe that just comes with the territory.
Yeah, good point.
Do you guys think that Paul took all that in the right way? Like, because I mean, he did end up quitting this job, but he stayed sort of in correctionals, and right, it says that like he went to work for like Boys Youth Center or something like that. Like I pictured him like traveling like that early Hulk TV show, or even like, what was that, Highway to Heaven, where he would go like town to town, working on different miles, like learning different lessons, and there would be a series of him.
I feel like he learns enough lessons here to hold him over for a long time. Like,
I feel like that would have expanded the one thing I really don't care for in this movie and made it like even worse. Like, I kind of like that he doesn't do that and he ends up kind of just dealing with it internally for 108 or not 108 years, but for the bulk of that 180 years, you know, and he ends up in a nursing home and he's, you know, taking care of people there, kind of. So yeah, I think that if they had gone in that route, I would have disliked it way more. But I mean, this is a minor gripe for this movie. I love so much of it that, you know, it's just, if I have to find something to pick on, that's kind of it.
Do you think it's fair that he's basically, I guess, immortal, but has to age? Like, that seems shitty.
I kind of like this type of, because he's not immortal, you know what I'm saying? He's just got extended life, right? So his life expectancy is maybe doubled, is the way I thought of it. So maybe almost double, because he's like 40-something when he gets the touch. And when we meet him, he's like 108 or so. So he probably is going to live to be like 150 or maybe 140. So I think they gave him like an extra 100 years or so.
You've got to consider that whatever John Coffey passed on to Mr. Jingles extended a mouse's life for about 70 years. Like, what's that going to do to a human being whose life expectancy is far longer than that?
Right. So, I mean, it just seems unfair that, like, I mean, he's a spry 108-year-old, but still, like, he's not still Tom Hanks. You know what I mean? Like, he aged dramatically. And like, what happened to Bonnie Hunt? Like, it's not like, you know, that's tough, right?
They did establish that, you know, whatever this magical ability is, it is not immortality. You know, John Coffey, he does die. He is capable of being killed. So I think it's reasonable to assume that one could age physically.
Yeah, yeah. I think the idea was it's not when he cures you, it's because he showed him the vision, right? And it's because he like shocked Mr. Jangles during the execution. Like, it was different moments. So like when he cured Patricia Clarkson, right? Like, that didn't supernaturally extend her life past her regular life. You know what I'm saying? Like, she's going to live on for a little while, but I feel like because he sort of gave him this vision, he had to transfer part of himself. But yeah, I don't know. It does kind of suck. I didn't think he was going to live that much longer. You know, I thought we saw Jangles take his last breath at the end of this movie, so I figured his would be soon.
I don't know.
It kind of does end on like a very downbeat though, right? He's like, I am a monster. He's like, I have to witness all of this death. He's like, I've been gifted this life, but it is a curse. The end. I was like, whoa, okay.
Oh boy, that's a heavy cross to bear. Some other notes that I made from this movie. I remembered very, very, very little about this movie since I watched it for the first time, maybe like a decade ago. But I did remember what's weird is that I remembered that they didn't wet the sponge. Like, I remembered that part of it, but I did not remember the extent to which that impacts things, right? Like, that I was just like, oh, I remember what happens here. I was like, oh wait, no, I don't remember what happens here at all. Apparently, it is some ghastly like horror film shit, like just over the top, like 80s style. Almost like these like crazy intense blue flames, and it's crazy. It's I was like, how do I remember the one thing but not like what that one thing leads to?
Well, I must have blocked some of that out too, because I knew what was going to happen to him, but I didn't remember it going on that far and then yelling about the smell, and then I started gagging and I was like, oh dear lord, like that is, I mean, Darabont is one hell of a director.
I remembered quite a bit of it, but I think that I had forgotten about how brutal the actual electrocution is. Like, I remember it vomit on the floor and all of that, but like just seeing him being electrocuted, that visual, I had totally forgotten. And that kind of struck me as a little bit extreme. That entry into the serial actually has my favorite of the titles. That one's called The Bad Death of Edouard Delacroix. And goddamn if that doesn't live up to that title.
I will say that the special effects there I thought were pretty cool. The special effects that did not age well 20 years later are the death flies or the illness flies or whatever thing like that. It's almost like I watched so much of the X-Files. This happened in the run of that. And like, even early X-Files effects were usually better than this, right? Like, I don't know why. I don't know why they tried to get maybe just too computer fancy with it, but it just seems like the technology was not there. Not that it really took me out of it too much, but I was just like, oh, this does not really look great. It just, you know, for everything else is so specific to the time and the era and the place, and even like the crazy death of Edouard Delacroix, like all of that is still pretty good. And then the flies are just like, oh, this is not great.
Yeah, I even noticed Mr. Jingle's CGI was a little bit dodgy, but at the same time, they really don't have a whole lot of CG effects shots in this movie.
Right, which I think is why it stands out more, maybe, right? Because there's not anything else like that.
Possibly.
Yeah, because, like, you know, Mr. Jangles is like, you know, Mouse Hunt, which is great. You know, I think that whole movie's a CGI mouse or something, and I think he comes off fine because of all the interaction that he does with, or that the characters are doing with real mouse. The Death Flies is something that seems like it would be an easy effect at the time, right? It's just like this quick little particle effect kind of thingy, but, like, yeah, it just did not age well, but I'm sure at the time was, like, perfectly acceptable. But there's some way that I feel like they could have done that practically and gotten away with it with, like, dust or something. And they do something kind of similar in Dr. Sleep where they suck the steam out of people. Like, I feel like they could have changed it to a mist or a smoke or something like that and had the same sort of effect. But,
you know, we made a lot of, especially Mike, you were mentioning earlier, a lot of the people who were back from other movies and the supporting cast characters. We did not mention Gary Sinise back for his third Tom Hanks movie, very briefly, but he's in this movie very briefly. In terms of going back in terms of Tom Hanks movies, we have, like I said before, an old man actor playing Hanks. I think this might be the earliest movie, the earliest time period that Tom Hanks is in. I was trying to think of, like, which ones there are, and I realized he's been in a lot. Every time we say goodbye is like World War II. A League of Their Own is World War II. Saving Private Ryan is World War II. Apollo 13 is the 60s. That Thing You Do is the 60s. Like, he's been back in time a lot, but I don't think we've gone back as far as 1935 before, have we?
What period of time is Road to Perdition?
I don't know, but we haven't gotten there yet.
But you just jogged my memory. You said League of Their Own. Do you know what this movie has in common with A League of Their Own?
Well, that was my last and final note before I get to the trivia, is that there is a, in kind of a reversal of fortune, Tom Hanks cannot piss in this movie. In a career full of just him urinating and talking about urination in, like, every movie, he is unable to do so here. Just, there's that long, long pee scene in A League of Their Own. There's him talking to the president in Forrest Gump. And there's a couple other scenes, I feel like, where he's just peeing or talking about peeing. But here, I was like, oh, it's the anti-Hanks.
But then he finally relieves himself at one moment, right? And I want to, like, line that up with the League of Their Own when he busts into the locker room to relieve himself and see which one is longer, because he has to hold the record for longest leak in a major motion picture. And that is quite a title. And if I ever meet him in person, I was going to say hello, Pardew, a holy man, and ask him to juggle. But now I'm going to congratulate him on holding that record, if that indeed is true.
This movie was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, Best Picture, which it lost to American Beauty, Best Supporting Actor, Michael Clark Duncan, which lost to your boy, Michael Caine, in your movie, Cider House Rules, Best Adapted Screenplay lost to Cider House Rules, and Best Sound lost to The Matrix. So, you know, that's appropriate. So some trivia, Stephen King called this film the single most faithful adaptation of his work, which is...
More than The Langoliers?
Man, The Langoliers, that dual VHS copy, loved it, with Balky.
I love that, Bronson Pinchot.
Tom Hanks accepted the role of Paul Edgecombe as a favorite of Frank Darabont because he had to turn down the Andy Dufresne role in Shawshank to play Forrest Gump. This, I don't know where this came from, but Tom Hanks treated the entire crew to a meal every Friday night on set, so that's very kind of him. Michael Clark Duncan was the soul of the cast, according to a producer, and Tom Hanks cried when Michael Clark Duncan wrapped shooting. Tom Hanks apparently stayed in character when Stephen King visited the set, and Stephen King asked if he wanted to sit in Old Sparky, which they called the electric chair, and he said no, because he was in charge of the block, so I think that's a weird kind of bit of method acting that I don't think we've seen so far from Tom Hanks, at least we've heard about, you know what I mean? They wanted to cast Hanks as the, or have him play the old man too, but the makeup effects just did not work, so they cast Dabs Greer instead. And I think this was his final movie. I think he died relatively shortly after this movie came out.
Nowadays, they would have definitely done, like, the old aging, like Captain America aging or something, like reversed sort of Irishman kind of makeup that they do these days, digital makeup.
Tom Hanks in this movie is about, quote, great myths that communicate the complexities of being a human, which feels a very flowery way of saying, like, it's difficult being a person. Kind of, right? Like, it's just like living is tough. In Dr. Sleep, you mentioned Dr. Sleep before, Mike, which, if people don't know, is a sequel to The Shining. Danny Torrance senses someone's dying and experiences as insects and flies in the same way that flies come out of John Coffey's mouth when he heals people. In Dr. Sleep, Danny even speaks Percy's line, dead man walking. Also in Dr. Sleep, flies portend something bad about to happen, such as before Percy is institutionalized.
Nice. That's some of that interconnection between the King universe.
That's some real Castle Rock stuff right there. And the only other trivia that I have here is is the actors who were almost in parts. Jennifer Lopez turned down the Melinda Moore's role, who is the brain tumor woman, which I don't see that. Shaquille O'Neal was considered for the role of John Coffey, which I get because if he wants to be like a mountain of a man, right? Josh Brolin auditioned for the role of Wild Bill Wharton, which would obviously go to Sam Rockwell. And then the final part is for the Paul Edgecombe role. John Travolta was offered it, but turned it down. And Michael Keaton and Michael Douglas were both considered, but obviously it went to Tom Hanks, which is why we're talking about it tonight.
Yeah, I could not see Travolta. Sorry, Travolta.
Well, could you see Tom Cruise? Do you think Tom Cruise could play the role of Paul Edgecombe, or if not, Paul Edgecombe, or if not, what role could Tom Cruise play in this movie? Because there are plenty of dudes in this movie.
Well, talk about someone who could nail the Wild Bill role. I think he would be crazy as, I mean, you know, he's too old, I think, to do Wild Bill at this point. But you know, I'd never seen him, you never really see him that unhinged. And I feel like he could get there real quickly and real easily and sort of sustain that energy for a really long time. I mean, I also feel like he could play the Hanks role. Like I was saying earlier, like, I just feel like, you know, Hanks, you know, part of it for me is, you know, it's Hanks. At this point, I think that's a lot of his movies, and I think that's good. I like that about it. But like, yeah, I think he just bring a different energy to that role. Too intense, maybe.
Dan, what about you? What do you think?
I think that this character requires a bit of softness to them, and I think Hanks is perfect for that. We're so used to Hanks being so likable and friendly in so many movies, and in rewatching this, I was reminded of just how well he can command authority when he has to. But I think inherently this character needs to have that softer edge for some of these more important scenes, and I just don't know that Cruise is the guy for that. I mean, it's been so long since he's done something other than an action movie of some sort, so it can be difficult for me to envision young Tom Cruise, but even then he'd be maybe too young for this role. So I mean, I'm gonna say no. I don't think he has the dynamics to pull this character off, at least not as good as Tom Hanks does.
I think we're at an interesting point in Tom Cruise's career in 1999 where, like, it almost like 5 years, 6 years earlier, like when we're talking like The Firm, even like from like 93 to 96, Mike, I think like The Firm through like Jerry Maguire, I think I could kind of see it. So I think he was kind of doing different things. And I feel like, you know, as we sort of talked about, when Mission Impossible comes around, he enters a new stratosphere, right? And like, it's sort of, he's, I mean, we're currently, as we're recording this, you know, the episodes of Cruise Club that are releasing kind of concurrently with this one, he's in a very, very weird stretch of his career, right? Where it's like, you know, he's playing a Nazi, he's playing Marco Rubio, essentially. He's not doing action movies, really. He's doing all sorts of different things. And so he's been non-action star Cruise at different phases in his career. But I feel like around this time, even though in 99 when he did Magnolia and Eyes Wide Shut, like, I don't know that this is in that. I think he could do it, because I still am firmly of the belief that he could do any kind of role. But I also don't know that it's necessary. I don't know that he would do it as well, because I do think Dan was the one who said it, that like, there's a softness to Paul Edgecombe that like Cruise has embodied but normally doesn't. And I think as we talk about in different episodes that we do, Mike, where you kind of cast one of these guys and it's sort of a shortcut into, I know what type of character it is because it's the type of character that Tom Cruise is playing, and you can either lean into that or subvert it. But I feel like you don't get the benefits either way with a character like this. It's just like, oh, it just, this is something different. It almost throws you for a loop, right? And like, he could do it, but I don't know that it necessarily is as effective as if Tom Hanks was in the role as he is.
I almost feel like, you know, who knows, but I almost feel like he wouldn't do this kind of role. Like, it just doesn't feel like, you know, as far as his sort of things are going at this time, that interesting. Like, it doesn't feel like stretching enough, like, for at least from what we've been seeing the last few films, you know, like you said, like, he played a disfigured Nazi, he played like this, he was behind all this makeup in the last couple of roles and stuff. And so maybe he'd be more of a Percy at this point in his career and be able to like really kill that. But I also like who they got for that role. So yeah, maybe just not involved.
So now an equally important question, and I don't know the answer to this really. Does Tom Hanks in this movie do anything? I think the answer is probably no, which is a good thing. Does he do anything to jeopardize his role as America's dad? Dan, I don't know if you've been on since we've basically twisted the question a little bit. We used to ask if he did anything to set him on the path to becoming America's dad, but I feel like we realized 5 or 6 movies ago now that he is firmly, officially America's dad. So we want to see now if he's doing anything to like break him from that. And I feel like, you know, he's a kind, gentle, patient, but still can be stern or strict prison guard. And I feel like he's kind of a father figure to both the inmates and the other guards to a certain extent.
Yeah, I don't think he does anything to dethrone him from that title. But I will say that anytime I hear Tom Hanks drop an F-bomb, it's a little bit jarring to me at first. And he definitely does that here. So I think that, I mean, not to say he doesn't do it well or that it's unconvincing, but because I'm so used to Tom Hanks, seeing him in a certain light,
right,
that seeing him, again, command authority here and drop F-bombs, he's a prison guard, right? So he's playing the character and he's doing it well. But me as an audience member, I see Tom Hanks, I don't expect F-bombs to come out of his mouth. And then I hear them and it's so off-putting. So that's the worst I could say, really.
Yeah. And I mean, even the best dads still curse from time to time, right? So I mean,
that's what I'm saying. You know, yeah.
All right. I think.
I mean, his son is Chet Hanks, right? Oh, so one's going to slip back from time to time.
Before we nominate this for some awards, is there any other final thoughts about The Green Mile, good, bad, or otherwise?
There was one thing that really made me laugh out loud, and it was quite early. And, you know, this is when Hanks is having trouble with the UTI and stuff. And so, like, he gets up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and he has to go out back to the outhouse.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Oh, well, because it's the 30s, you know? Like, there's no...
But when was indoor plumbing a thing?
Maybe in a big city or something, but like down in the where they are in Louisiana.
True, like, and they do make a point that like he lives out in the middle of nowhere in the woods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I thought that was great. He like collapses halfway to the outhouse, and then I think if I'm not mistaken, the toilet is actually called the water closet at the prison. So I love all those little details.
And Dan, what about you? Any other thoughts about The Green Mile before we give this some awards?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. As far as Frank Darabont's prison-based Stephen King adaptations go, I don't know that I love this more than The Shawshank Redemption, but it definitely hits me in the feels a lot harder than Shawshank does. But I love both. I think that if Frank Darabont just wanted to make more prison movies, I'd be okay with this movie's great.
Yeah. And prison movies as a genre, if you can consider it a genre, very underrated, I feel like. Often great.
Are there more Stephen King prison stories to be told here that Darabont can sort of, I guess, come out of retirement to do? I don't know what he's up to.
One thing, I mean, it's not really a full prison book, but like the first, like what frustrates me about the Outsider miniseries, limited series on HBO is that like the first third of that is kind of like a police procedural. And there's a lot of, you know, Coach Terry in prison and everything. Like, you know, basically the premise of the big thing that happens in the show happens 200 pages into a 600 page book. And like the first third of it is kind of like transcripts and police blotter. And like, it's very cool. And like, it's like a cop show almost. And then it sort of evolves.
That's kind of King's thing in the past, I don't know, maybe 10 years or so. I mean, he wrote Mr. Mercedes, which was the beginning of a 3-part, you know, cop story. It's more of a mystery than it is anything else. I don't even think I would classify it.
Right. And then we get Holly Gibney going from that universe into the Outsider universe.
Right. So I think that's just kind of the track he's on right now, is telling cop stories, not necessarily prison stories.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Because also what really interested me, and I also read, because it's just fresh in my mind, I read this year, The Institute, which I think is his book from last year, probably. So what frustrated me about that is that it's about without spoiling more about it, but it's about an institute of kids who are collected, who have some kind of psychic abilities. It's told from their perspective, and you don't really know what's going on, but things are sort of amiss, right? Because they're like abducted and taken or whatever. But the book starts out with like 60 or 80 or 100 pages of this former police officer who was like, who had like an unfortunate thing happen to him in Florida. And so he was let go, and then he's making his way up the coast. And like, it's like this great, like you were saying earlier, Dan, like this everyday man, you know, in this world of black and white, like he's just an everyday, he's just a normal guy. And I'm like, this is a cool story. I'm into this character. And then it becomes a book about a bunch of kids. And then by the time you finally get back to the guy at the end, I don't care anymore. Like, I feel like, to your point that Stephen King is all about like cop stories, like it feels like that's definitely true of the two books that I've read from the last 2 or 3 years or whatever, but I think he does them well. I think that they're really fascinating. It's just when they stray from that, when they get a little bit more supernatural, they sort of change the protagonist, then I'm not really on board. But this is not a Stephen King podcast. This is a Tom Hanks podcast. So I apologize for that deviation, but let's nominate this for some awards. Best film, worst film. I think we got to go best film, right?
For sure.
All right. Best role, yes or no? I feel like in a movie where he's really good, I don't know that this is like, I don't know that it's him.
I don't know. I feel like this movie is more of a sum of its parts than like, yeah, Hank's sort of like carrying it, even though, you know, he's the lead, clearly. Like
if you're naming five iconic Hanks roles, do you put this, is this anywhere near the list?
I don't think so. I mean, unfortunately, even Forrest Gump is on that list, right? You just have to like that's what I mean. Like that really, you know, something that really jumps out. Like
Dan, is that blasphemous to you that we're not considering this one of his best roles?
No, I understand what you're saying. If I were to, I mean, for the most part of the, in this movie, he's kind of playing himself in a lot of ways.
He's himself, and he's also like the audience surrogate, kind of, right? Like he's just like,
right,
we're experiencing the prison through him. It's his, we are him, kind of.
Right. I think he does a masterful job of playing this character, but in terms of, you know, is this an iconic role for him? Probably not.
And I don't want to say, like, he's good in this movie. I don't want to take that away from him. Not that, you know, anybody cares at all what we say, but like, I'm not insulting him. It's just that you're right. Like it's more of a sum of its parts. It's more about the ensemble, which is the next thing I'm going to nominate this for best ensemble. Just it's about everyone. It's not like it's a Tom Hanks story. It's a Tom Hanks character story, but it's not really. Like, he's just the one who happens to be telling the story. Like, if it was, you know, Barry Pepper telling the story, it would basically be the same movie, right? Like, it'd just be, right? So, I don't know.
Right, yeah, I don't think he stands out far and above anyone else in this movie. I think everyone is really bringing a lot of good work to it. Not in a way that he does in, say, Forrest Gump, which is weirdly another ensemble cast, but he is, like, the focal point of that movie. You know what I mean? Everyone else is taking a step back, whereas everyone in this movie kind of takes a step forward and joins him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm not too perturbed by not nominating him for this.
Now, best fight. Does he get into a fight?
He gets kneed in the balls by Wild Bill.
Oh yeah, the Wild Bill scuffle.
But is that on par with like the 3D fight in Bachelor Party or Buzz and Woody versus the Misfit Toys in Toy Story?
I don't think so.
So we can skip that. Best dance scene. I don't think that he dances. Best party scene, no. Best Hanks outfit wardrobe. I think it's cool to see him in the prison uniform guard, but I don't think this is one of his most iconic or best outfits. Best death, he does not die. Best line or best freak out? Is there in here? There's one line, like I feel like of the memorable lines in this movie, I don't know that they're his, but there's one that I really liked that I wrote down, which was, "This is not a good time, John Coffey, not a good time at all," as he's laying on the ground. You know, I think that was maybe after he got kneed in the balls, and he's just like,
yes.
And that's when he gets healed. He's just like, basically like, "Not now, man, I'm in pain." I thought that was just like a very funny delivery. The soundtrack theme score?
I think the score is pretty good, but I might be the only person to vote for that.
Best or worst Hanks love story? I know that you love him with Bonnie Hunt in this, but Mike, how do you think this compares? Should we nominate Hanks and Bonnie Hunt here or no?
No, I mean, this isn't like Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah, it's basically like, can the relationship beat him and Meg Ryan in three movies? And the answer is no. And then best non-Hanks actor, male or female, is there someone particular that stands out? Or I think I'm happy leaving it just as best ensemble, but...
Yeah, I was gonna sort of start singling people out, but everybody's so good. Like, I mean, all the powerful performances, all sort of like, you know, I don't want to like say one over the other, but I mean, Dan, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm kind of feeling the same way. If I was going to pick anybody, it might be Doug Hutchinson, because who's going to nominate him for anything else? But yeah, if you want to leave it up to ensemble, I think that's definitely, that's fair.
Cool. So I think we just have the two awards, but there are two big ones. There's the best ensemble and there's best film. Oh, wait, and wait. Oh, we also have Gary Sinise. I was like, why is there a third one? But we also nominated Gary Sinise in Forrest Gump, Apollo 13, and also The Green Mile, because he's in this for a little bit. So, well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us on this episode.
Oh, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure having you to talk about Mr. Tom Hanks or Mr. Tom Cruise or whatever else. So thank you for joining us.
Oh, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Mike, next episode of Hanks, you and I are going, we're going to get stranded on an island for Castaway. But between now and then, we have to go to, I don't know where, a beach, I think? I keep thinking there's a beach in this movie. Night and Day for Cruise Club. So go check out Cruise Club, Night and Day.
A date with Cameron Diaz, mm-hmm. Apparently.
And last week, we mentioned it earlier, Valkyrie, Cruise Club, most recent episode of that came out last Friday, Valkyrie. So go check out Valkyrie, all 31 episodes of Cruise Club, and all 31 episodes of Hanks for the Memories at cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, hanks@cageclub.me. Come back next episode for Castaway or next week on Cruise Club for Night and Day. Go check out all nearly 1,500 podcast episodes at cageclub.me and just, you know, say hi. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Dan Colonna. We'll see you next time right here on Hanks for the Memories.
not a good time. Joan Coffey, not a good time at all.